Taking Stock with Pim Fox and Carol Masser. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
All right, somehow I can't imagine our next guest dancing to this song, but he's an interesting individual, and I've been lucky enough to spend some time with him and talk to him about his career and what he's involved in. So I'm looking forward to bringing in John Castle. He's the chairman of Castle Harlan. He's an adventurer. He's done some amazing things in his life, but he really is known for being a pioneer in the creation of private equity limited partnerships. He's known for buying distressed properties, and a lot of them are mid-sized, some of those smaller names that are out there. So he joins us in studio. Great to have you here with him and myself.
Terrific, Carol. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me over.
It's a treat. It's a real treat. And you do focus on distressed opportunities, John. And I know you told me you do a ton of research. I've seen the bags of research that are in your office. When you look at the environment right now, are there a lot of opportunities or not so much right now?
There are many, many opportunities. Perhaps not as many as a year ago. I think a year ago, people were contemplating the tax increase at the end of the year and so forth. So a lot of people rushed to market to sell their companies a year ago. Now we're kind of over that peak, and they're not rushing to market in quite the same way. Notwithstanding that, we have lots and lots of, I think there was 22 specific investments that we were looking, company opportunities we were looking at this last Monday.
22.
Now it isn't clear that we'll get very many of those done because we look at hundreds of things for every one we do. But there seems to be a very good flow in the market. The market for companies, prices are, if you have a really good company, really beautiful company, no problems, the prices are pretty good, very, very attractive, high. On the other hand, we live in an environment where if there's any little problem with the company, people are not interested. And so you can either sell out at quite a high price or you might not be able to sell at all.
You landed a small plane. I'm sorry. I got to go to the adventure part.
I knew he was going to go there.
I love, you got the tie and the suit and everything, but you weren't wearing that, I bet, when you landed that small plane on the North Pole back in 1993.
I've been accused of wearing a tie.
Really? Everywhere?
Everywhere I go.
All right. Wait a minute. You did this in the North Pole in 1993.
He's then been to both the North and the South Pole.
In 2003, you landed a small plane on the South Pole. I hope you got clearance for that. You trekked to the base of Mount Everest in 1993, and you also got the Hinckley sailboat. You circumnavigated the planet.
Right, right.
I told you he was an adventurer.
I know that. How do you go from MIT and Harvard? Because we were just up in Boston yesterday.
Well, it's easy to go from MIT because MIT men are concerned about angles and navigation.
I thought because you were going to say that because it was right on the water anyway. You just got right into
that
the
too.
When you go to the South Pole, for instance, you're probably using the sun as your navigational aid. And for MIT mind, this is really, really exciting, a lot of fun because you're figuring out all the angles and all the details. And the angle of the sun above the horizon as well as the direction to your target, the South Pole.
I bring up these adventures for a reason, because I'm wondering if you can describe a little bit of your own adventure from MIT, from Harvard, to the head of DLJ, Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenrette, because many people may not be familiar with your career.
Well, I was, as you say, I was an undergraduate at MIT. I left MIT. I went to the Harvard Business School. I did.
Did you know you wanted to go to business school?
Absolutely. Even though I went to MIT and studied engineering and scientific kinds of subjects. I actually come from a family where my grandfather owned five businesses. Each grandfather owned about five businesses. My father owned about five businesses. So I've just been doing what my grandfathers and father did, perhaps on somewhat larger scale. But
I think you told me that when you were really young, you kind of knew that you were going to go with as a result of kind of growing up in this business environment.
Absolutely. As a 5-year-old, I can remember going out and collecting rents with my grandfathers because that's what we did on the first day of the month, which we had to go collect. He owned most of Main Street. He would collect rent on Main Street.
And I'm wondering if you can connect that with what's going on now in the country, because at one point, I know this particularly during the November presidential election, there was a lot of conversation about the demonization of business as part of the campaigning process, whether it was private equity, whether it was still is the banking industry to
hedge
a certain
funds.
Extent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what your, you know, because you grew up in it, you got to see it and build it.
Well, I don't think people demonized it in quite the same sense 50 or 60 years ago as they are today. I think it's extremely unfortunate that we have a country which has seemed sort of being separated. This dichotomy is being created in our country where there's perceived to be these owners of businesses and then there are people who aren't owners of business. As you know, I'm a reasonably good Republican, and I don't like the fact that the President of the United States keeps trying to pull the country apart as opposed to bring people together. I think great leaders in the country have to be people who say, hey, we got to pull together, we got to work together, and I think that will bring the best out of everyone. And so I don't. It's very disappointing when we have someone who is taking the position that businessmen are evil or
you know, it's interesting. We're just back from Boston, and they really emphasize the private public partnership and certainly in coming together after the marathon bombing.
The one fund that was established to help the victims of the Boston
government,
marathon bombing.
Private mm-hmm. enterprise really came together. I mean, I understand what you're saying about the president, John, but there's isn't it a little bit on every side and both parties kind of just not working together?
Carol, we shouldn't get into talking about politics today. Up in Boston, one of the elements that was very important between the academic world and the business world was at MIT, where you had all these great scientists and people like that, many of whom were on faculties at MIT and so forth, and then who went out and created businesses. I'm not familiar with, or I don't have the numbers at my fingertips at the moment, but there were millions and millions of jobs that were created out of that process. Many, many important industries that were growing and developed technologies of all different kinds and so forth. And that process continues on, and it's a wonderful washing of hands between the academic.
Hang on a second. We're talking with John Castle. He's chairman of Castle Harlan. Our conversation continues. This is Taking Stock on Bloomberg Radio.
We're speaking with John Castle. He is the chairman and chief executive of Castle Harlan. It's a private merchant bank. It's got, 42,000 employees. And he's also the chairman and chief executive of Branford Capital that makes long-term investments in small to mid-sized companies. Oh, and just a couple of other things that he's doing in his spare time. He just happens to be the head of co-publisher of Castle Connolly Medical. And I want to ask about the top doctors in the United States, John. How did you pick the top doctors? Because we were talking during the break, you might find the top doctor at a specific hospital, but it's a challenge to find the best one for whatever ails you.
I spent many, many years involved in medicine, and I was chairman of the board of New York Medical College, and the president of the college was John Conley. And I was forever getting requests from people to say, oh, you know, there's a new problem in the family. The dad's got a problem with the ticker. Mom's got some other problem or whatever. And who do we go see? And so I was always going to Conley to try to identify the top doctor, the right doctor to send people to. Out of that process, combined with I was on the Joint Commission that accredits all the hospitals in the United States, I concluded there was a real need to help people identify the best doctor for any medical condition they have. We use peer reviews to do that, which is to say we ask doctors to nominate doctors. We're pretty sure we know that peer reviews are more likely to get to a better answer as far as that is on that issue, as opposed to say consumers saying, "Oh, Dr. So and So has a nice bedside manner." Sometimes the top doctor doesn't have a nice bedside manner. I wish they always did, but they don't always. And so through that, we identify the top doctors in the United States. We publish books. Have one book with 6,000 doctors. which are about the top 1% of all the practicing physicians in the United States. We have other books like New York's Top Doctors that carry about 10% of all the top doctors in the United States. We also supply U.S. News and World Report with all of their top doctors. So if you go on U.S. News and World Report and look up a top doctor, it's a Castle Connolly selected doctor. Or New York Magazine, it's a Castle Connolly selected. Every year they come out with their June edition with top doctors. And so we have what we think are very comprehensive processes headed up by a lady doctor, Dr. Jean Morgan, who along with her team of people vet all of these selections and so forth. And our belief is that if you get to the top doctor, the outcomes are likely to be much, much better than if you just go to an average doctor.
Not only the outcomes, John, but does it also have something into the cost of healthcare, that if you really get to somebody who understands it, knows how to deal with it quickly, you're not doing unnecessary testing and so on and so forth?
Exactly. It may cost more, but in many, many cases on the long term, there are 35 million doctor searches done every year on the Castle Connolly website. Of course, everyone's welcome to come and take a
Pim
peek.
And I will be there.
Or you can call me.
I will do that. I have a few problems. Basel III.
Sure.
This is a sharp turn, but I'm going to go there because...
Explain what it is for people that don't maybe think it's spelled B-A-S-I-L, because it's not.
Right. It's aimed at strengthening bank capital requirements by increasing bank liquidity, bank leverage. It's all a result of coming off the financial crisis and hoping to make the financial system safer. But you're looking at me with a skeptical eye.
The situation is Basel III is resulting in a tightening up of a lot of standards associated with the banking system. The point that I would make is that there's this inconsistency in American policy. As you know, the Federal Reserve is going forth and keeping interest rates down, buying up government, a variety of various kinds of securities and so forth, doing all kinds of things to keep interest rates very, very low because they feel like that's a great way to stimulate the economy. Now, another way, though, that you really do stimulate the economy is if small and medium-sized businesses are in a position to borrow money and maybe add another store to their chain, or
expand their factory. Because they're the real backbone, right?
Right. If they can expand their factory, if they can do those kinds of things, that stimulates the economy. And under the Basel III standards that are being imposed by the regulators, including the Federal Reserve, it makes it, because of the charges, credit charges that are made against the bank, makes it considerably more difficult for them to loan money to companies, to businesses.
We've seen it play out that way.
Absolutely. And I've had a very senior officer in one of the country's biggest banks tell me that unless a company is investment grade, it's almost impossible for them to loan money to it now because of the capital charges. Investment grade, by that mean...
Hang on, because we want to continue the conversation. I've got to take a quick break, but John Castle stays with us. This is Taking Stock, and we're talking with John Castle. He's Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Castle Harlan. And John, forgive me, because I did interrupt you because we had to take a moment away. But you were making a point about Basel III and how that's preventing a lot of lending to some of those small and mid-sized businesses.
Because of the capital charges, Carol, it's very difficult for banks to make loans to businesses these days. I'd heard from one senior officer of a bank saying that unless a company is of investment grade, it's almost impossible for his bank to give a loan. Now, for a company to be investment grade, it's probably got to be close to $1 billion in sales, certainly well over $500 million in sales. And the point I'm getting at is that as far as sort of middle-sized companies, family companies, companies that we know around the country, these large banks are just not in a position to make loans to them. In the case of one New York-based, very, very large bank, I'd noticed that their business loans, their C&I loans called commercial and industrial loans, which are loans to businesses, mm-hmm. are only 8% of their loan portfolio. 40 years ago, it would have been 50% of their loan portfolio. So the old feeling that a small businessman could go to his local bank and get a few dollars and add on to his store.
Not so much.
Not so much anymore. It just doesn't work that way. And there people are getting money, but they're getting it from commercial lenders such as, in some cases, GE, sometimes CIT. Actually, many of the hedge funds have set up subsidiaries that are now or affiliates mm-hmm. that are now making loans that were historically made by banks. There are a few insurance companies that are doing it. But the geographic breadth and coverage of these institutions isn't anything like the banking system historically was. And
so it's not a good trend. It's not good to have them taking the role.
Well, it would be better if commercial banks were taking the role. So basically, rules such as Basel III means that large banks aren't loaning money to medium-sized and smaller businesses. And my point is that that's constraining growth. So on the one hand, you have the the Federal Reserve going out and driving interest rates to effectively zero. And on the other hand, they have the banker who might make loans to smaller businesses in kind of a chokehold. And they're wondering, why aren't things growing faster? Well, I think that Basel III and the implications of it are that it's going to be very difficult for banks to loan money. And as long as you may be whipping your horse, but you hold him very tightly with the reins, you may not get the outcome that you'd like. You need to have your activities be complementary as opposed to contrary to one another.
Is this like trying to sail across the Pacific without a sail or without a motor?
It's actually if you want to sail across the Pacific, you want to sail in the middle because you have trade winds that go from east to west, and that's very favorable. If you go up to the northern part of the Pacific, you have westerlies that go from west to east. Now, if you're trying to get across the Pacific from Panama to Australia, and you take the northern route, it's going to be really tough.
This is what's happening in the banking industry.
Exactly.
It's like they're blowing the wind in the wrong direction.
Exactly.
But, you didn't want to talk politics.
Right.
But I got to push you then. Is this political? Because this didn't drop from the sky, right? I mean, these rules are made by people.
Right. I think it's I'm not going to blame the president for this. I think this is one of those things that people just don't understand what the heck is going on. They aren't.
But who are the people that made the rules? I thought they were supposed to be experts.
Didn't they
ask you? Obviously, you ran DLJ. You run Castle Harlan. You've got all this expertise. Why wouldn't they call you on the phone and say, look, John, tell us what would be good to make this happen.
Well,
you've got experience making
this
work.
My phone line is available to them if they want to bring me.
why wouldn't they have people that know this kind of stuff? Yeah. And that, you mean, how many businesses have you managed to acquire, work out, bring to market? I mean, just give us an estimate.
Hundreds.
Mm-hmm. Well, give us an example just so people have it in your mind. What was like one of your favorite businesses that you had?
Well, over the year, I've been in all sorts of oil services businesses, seismic and things of that nature. I've been involved in pollution control businesses.
Restaurants?
Restaurants of all various kinds, high-priced ones like Morton's, lower-priced ones like Burger King.
So why wouldn't they call someone like you that's got this experience and say, gee, maybe you have a thought, maybe you have something to contribute?
Well, that's a good point. Pen. I think maybe they should call some people who, but I can say that there's a inconsistency in government policy here, and for everything they're doing with interest rates, they're offsetting by things that they're doing by constraining banks and so forth. And
so what about these groups they bring down in Washington, John? You know that they do these CEO roundtables, whether it's just exclusively with the financial community or with its with the
entire
business.
Yeah, we have to cover them, right?
We have to cover them
all
ad
this
nauseam.
Stuff. They come out in front of the White House and they say things and everyone kind of goes, okay.
Yeah.
And everyone goes back to work or no work. Yeah.
Is it just all for show?
I think an awful lot of it's show. You know, the photo op is very important. The cameras are all set out to the north of the West Wing there, where they come out of the West Wing where the president is and other important people, and they turn on the lights and someone talks for a couple minutes, and then with reporters shouting questions.
But it's serious stuff. I mean, we talk about the need to have a very healthy financial system to make sure that the credit markets flow and so on and so forth. And you're kind of getting to the point that this is creating not such a healthy system, correct?
Absolutely. It means that, you know, a country that's going to grow and so forth, it helps to have strong financial institutions. You want to have strong banks and so forth, but you want to have institutions that are being supportive of the business community because banks that loan money will help create jobs.
How do we make sure they're being smart and safe? Because as you know, the financial crisis, everyone talks about the regulatory environment breaking down. So how do we make sure that we have that necessary lending going back and forth, and you make sure that you have banks being responsible?
Yeah. I think the unfortunately, the regulatory environment is often affected heavily by the political swings of things, and that it's either way too open or it's way too closed.
There's never a middle ground, is there?
And they just can't seem to find a middle ground. Perhaps having some strong old line professionals running it who are familiar with it over a long period of time would be constructive, as opposed to having a lot of political people involved in the process. I think it's also it's just one of those things where the need to create an environment of consistency is important. I think accounting rules are important.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of theoretical people who think fair value accounting is the right solution. But the simple facts are that fair value accounting only exacerbates these problems, and that accounting that was used from the 30s on, by the way, there were a lot of things that the people learned in the 30s they put into law, and then systematically over the last 50 or 60 years we have taken out of the, mm-hmm. the code, but having accounting policies that tend to stabilize the system as opposed to make it more volatile are very important, because a banker who wakes up in the morning thinking his bank is okay, and then because of fair value accounting finds
not so
he's
much.
Out of business at 4 o'clock. That's not a very...
We've got to run, unfortunately. And I'm going to put out on Twitter, because I was very lucky enough to spend some time with John down in West Palm Beach.
Palm Beach,
forgive me.
He renovated the entire... Kennedy
Winter
summer,
White House.
Winter White House.
And it's stunning, and he was wonderful to show me around, and it really is a wonderful piece of history. John Castle, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Carol. Thank you, Pim.
A real pleasure. This is Taking Stock on Bloomberg Radio.
Taking Stock, weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. In New York on Bloomberg 1130. In Boston on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM HD2. Or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.